Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 25th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Steve Gramsch. Today's session number is GRS 2001-03 and is titled Faith in Science, Current Scientific Problems Relevant to Christian Belief. Let's listen in.
I'd like to hear from you about current your understanding or your take on some of the current scientific problems that are.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
There you go.
It was my job.
Great,
mystery solved.
I thought it was mine. I went back and mine was in my room, so.
And I'll start off by sort of introducing these ideas, and we're all aware of these controversies. But what I'm particularly interested in is your take on it. Is how people feel generally who have faith in whatever that might be, a religious faith, but also look at these issues, because it's particularly instructive to me, and I'll tell you why. After I finished my graduate work, one of the things that I always wanted to do was to teach at the college level. And so typically what happens is that, in science at least, one goes to graduate school, and then you go and do a postdoctoral appointment or two, where you are more independent, where you don't necessarily have a research professor looking after you, and you go ahead and sort of outline your own project, and you carry it out to completion relatively independently. I mean, you do have some sort of guidance from a mentor, a professor, but in general, it's not so confining as graduate work. And so after I finished that, I always wanted to teach at the college level, and to my great fortune, as I was finishing up, there became available at my alma mater, Augustana College in Rock Island, an appointment there to teach. And so I applied for it and got it. And so I sort of did the opposite thing. I went ahead and taught for a while first, and I was going to teach for a while and then perhaps go back in the middle of that appointment somewhere and do my postdoctoral research. So after about 3 years there, I applied for a fellowship at the Carnegie Institution of Washington and got that. And so I went out there, and I actually never returned to Rock Island for various reasons, but one of them simply is that I'm quite enjoying what I'm doing right now. I hope someday to get back to the college classroom, but that's not in my immediate plans. Anyway, pulling that story into this perspective, I went out there and we decided to live in Virginia. And I think probably if we had it to do over again, we probably wouldn't live there. It's very expensive. But the reason we moved there was because there was a friend of mine from college, a very close friend, who was living in Virginia. And if you know anything about the Washington, D.C. area, once you get outside the limits of the District of Columbia, it's very spread out. And so we thought, well, okay, we visited here and know how far it is to get to various places, and it would be nice to have that point of contact, so we decided, okay, let's live in Virginia. And the schools were good, and so we heard about that, so everything seemed fine. So anyway, there's this friend of mine, And I did not know through all the years of college that he was what one might call a literal interpreter of the Bible. And I never knew this about him when I was friends with him in college, and a number of years had passed. We were over at their house.
He was a scientist?
No, he wasn't at all. He worked with computers. And his wife was a biology major at Augustana College, contemporary of mine, actually graduated with me. And so anyway, these were two people that I thought that I knew pretty well. We were over at their house for dinner one night. And just sort of talking around after dinner, this guy puts the question to me, "So what do you think about the theory of evolution?" And I said, "Well, yeah, right." So I said to him, "Well, I have no reason not to believe it. And I think that it has..." And of course we have to understand that the quote theory of evolution is very broad. There are many threads to it, and there are many ways of interpreting, I think, the scientific data. Incidentally, if you're aware or get Time magazine, you'll know that there's actually been a development recently in that area. In fact, it's just this past week, July 23rd, where they talk about some new discoveries and how that sort of influences the threads of the theory of evolution. But anyway, so I'm talking to this guy about it, and I also said that I didn't see any reason why it had to conflict with the Christian faith, or religious faith, for that matter, whether it's Christian or not. And so his wife was going in and out of the room, and she sat down, and the conversation had gone on to something that I'm a little more familiar with, and that's the controversy over the age of the earth. And I said, "I can't imagine," this is, you know, one of the things that I'll never ever forget that I said. And I said that I can't imagine that any educated person, and this is flash point right there, I can't imagine that any educated person would have trouble assimilating what we know from science about the fossil record and what we've determined about the age of the earth and religious faith. The look on her face could freeze the most hot lava anywhere. And she did not speak to me the rest of the evening, which was mercifully short. And I wrote a note later, you know, a thank you note saying thanks for dinner and all of that, and our families really enjoyed it and all. And I sort of obliquely apologized for my, not mistake, but my boldness in my claims. And I said that, I wrote that, well, when one studies this so often, it seems like it's, part of your understanding of the world. But anyway, I also didn't know that they had pulled their children out of the public schools in Fairfax County for the specific reason that they were teaching the age of the earth, the geological record, and, you know, the theory of evolution as a scientific theory in the schools. And they were very, very upset by that. And so they pulled their kids out and went and had them go to a very fundamentalist school in rural, not rural, but sort of out further in Virginia, where they explicitly excluded that from their curriculum. Explicitly. So anyway, and this was only a couple years ago, and so the reason that I'm so interested in this is because that episode is what sort of galvanized my thinking on this topic. Up to that time, I had sort of been aware of the topic and read things like Time Magazine and thought, okay, well, that's an interesting fact that people are debating this in life.
Was he Lutheran? If he went on to stand?
Well, I don't believe that he was raised as a Lutheran. His wife was actually raised as Presbyterian. Same church environment, actually, that my wife grew up in. They were in the same church, incidentally enough. But that's a whole other thread. Anyway, the reason, and here's where the story comes back around with all this discussion, is that I'm particularly interested in how people think about this. And so I've prepared a series of questions that might help me understand this better. One, I think in teaching has to, anyone who's been teaching any length of time at all realizes that you learn as much from the people you are speaking with as you do in your own learning. Just it happens to be different things that you learn. And so that's what I'd like to do today. And, you know, if we wind up solving the problem, then great. If we don't, then that's fine too. I would, however, like to pick up a couple things that might help us in our deliberations today, and that is just a couple of threads from yesterday, and that it's quite interesting, really. I think that we talked about the splitting of the Roman Empire into two, in the eastern and the western half. Rome was sacked, as we know, in the 5th century, very early on. The eastern capital of the empire, Constantinople, was not sacked until 1203. And so we find, even though the church leaders in the east had this sort of same idea about science and learning, that it needed to support theology, it was not the same. They didn't have the same problems due to the political instability that was definitely in place in the East. And the other is that in the Eastern Empire, one saw the emerging contact with the Islamic world and their view of science and learning was somewhat different. Maybe some of you had wished that contact had never taken place, because as we know, algebra came out of that, and it's the difficulty of many a school person. The rise of university learning in the West, approximately 1100, where these great universities were arising in Paris and in Spain, and particularly Oxford and Cambridge in England, evolved into these more departmentalized structures. I mean, they originally were founded to, you know, advanced learning in its general form, but of course the departmental structure started to develop, and one had natural philosophy and moral philosophy, rhetoric and law, and eventually one saw the secularization of these universities breaking away from church control. And scientific learning, I think we can imagine, was off and running then, and far outpaced the ability of the church to control what was going on there. And so that turns out to be, particularly in England, the rise of the, quote, scientific method as we know it. The hypothesis, the testing, the publication, the, you know, the conclusions, and the sort of the ongoing sweep of scientific inquiry. And so it turns out to be quite important, and that's really, that model really is still in force today, although the support mechanisms for science, I think, are obviously very different we have the National Science Foundation, and we have the National Institutes of Health, and these granting agencies, which really do support the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense, which support research in our country. Of course, many great scientific discoveries come out of corporate research laboratories, but that is, I think, becoming less and less the case anymore, as corporate research tends to be much more focused on the bottom line. But anyway, so we've seen, I think, that the application of this scientific method or its beginnings has resulted in spectacular advances in knowledge and understanding of the natural world. And in particular, and I wanted to mention this very, very as this very important aspect of it yesterday, was that they were research results that were important for people, that they were results that people could use. And particularly, we talked about the medicine, and we talked about sort of the organization of the cosmos, even though in both cases, Ptolemy and Galen had it wrong in large measure, that the results that they had were quite useful to people. Now, we also have seen that the church stood at a crucial point in the development of scientific thinking, and that it had a choice. One of the choices was to say, okay, well, let's use science to support the teachings that we're trying to promote. And I think one could argue that this is the way that the church really adopted their viewpoint. Or one could allow science to grow unrestricted and so let the chips fall where they may, and let's see what happens about what we can learn about the creation. And for various reasons, of course, the former was chosen and the latter was not. But the question I have for you today is, how do you think the Christian church has fared since then? Or the church in general? How do you think the church has fared in its support, not necessarily monetary support, but its moral support of the scientific enterprise? Or is it a non-issue? What do you think?
I think the church has largely not paid much attention.
Yes.
As a whole, that is, I think, about Christian people. I think as a whole, they're not very exercised about it. I may be wrong there.
Why do you suppose that is?
Doesn't seem to impinge on it.
Yeah.
But we do.
It's irrelevant, kind of, isn't
it? Really kind of irrelevant.
In a way.
Except evolution. I mean, that's the one thing people can get exercised about somewhat even.
Uh-huh.
But actually, I don't think people really feel... I mean, the scientific world is another world. I think we see ourselves in worlds apart.
Really?
We have many scientists who are Christians, but I mean... Mm-hmm. I don't think we see our worlds as really connecting much.
You had a comment?
Well, I don't know. I guess it depends on what you think is the role of the church. You know, if the role of the church is to, spread the faith in Christ or support that faith, then there may be worlds apart. But if the church has some kind of a moral obligation to the world, then they may start questioning some of the scientific research, mm-hmm. not interfering or stopping with it, because I think a lot of it, and probably the majority of it, is going to be compatible. But at what point may they insert religion and ethics type mm-hmm. of thing? Maybe the Human Genome Project. Oh, wait a minute, is this a good thing? Mm-hmm. What are the ramifications? What role should the church play? Are they going to use it for you know, for curing? Are they going to use it for discrimination? Mm-hmm. Those people with sickle cell disease, you know, too bad. But those with, you know, white Anglo-Saxon American diseases, they're going to benefit. You know, just taking, looking at it in a moral perspective. If that's the role of the church, then I'd say we should be really keeping on top of it.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And I think the moral aspect of it is a whole other dimension as opposed to the theological dimension.
Yeah, that's why I say, what's the role of the church?
Right.
You know, does it go into both issues? Or if you're just going to look at theology, maybe the ties are going to be looser than if you're going to look at some of the other ethical issues.
Yeah. Why do you suppose it is that there's, for instance, the theory of evolution? And on one level, I think the answer is simple, and that is that the theory of evolution conflicted with, you know, preconceived notions about that Christians had. But why? The deeper question is why did it conflict? Yeah.
Well, it just would seem even today that you talk to different people about evolution in the church, and they're willing to go along with evolution to the extent of the evolution of all animals and all plants except man.
Really?
Yeah, they want to leave man out of the picture. It's kind of like, well, man was created in the image of God. Well, if God was created, if man was created in the image of God, therefore he didn't or shouldn't, or whatever label, participate in evolution.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you come back to that person and say, well, then how about all the plants and animals?
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
Yeah.
And do you see any relationship between man in terms of his morphology?
Right.
And do you see any relationship between man and other animals? Well, at that point, it's almost like they close the door on science.
Uh-huh.
And it's, and another one, of course, one today too, and that is the homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, between evolution and homosexuality. I don't know which of the two. It seems like homosexuality right now is really the hotter issue when compared to evolution. You talk about Genesis, you get into Genesis,
right,
in the 7 days.
Uh-huh.
And to the person who is the literalist, you can walk through the 7 days and apply science to it. And really it could make sense if you really want to try to persuade. But my position would be, I teach biology, or I used to teach biology.
Uh-huh.
And so that's, to me, the church, I don't know if the church doesn't want to accept science because science might reveal too much to challenge what is actually being said in the Bible.
Even today?
Even today. Even today. Oh, yes. Well, in fact, we just had a discussion over lunch today about somebody brought it up. I did not bring it up, but somebody else brought it up on homosexuality. And I said, well, I asked the person, I said, well, you know, when you were growing up, did you ever experiment with profanity? Did you ever use a profane word? Oh, yeah. I said, did you ever experiment with smoking? Yeah, I used to smoke. But did you ever experiment with alcohol? No, I never did that. Oh, okay. Did you ever experiment with sex? Well, no, he didn't want to admit. But at that point, you know, but the point I was making is that so often when you talk about homosexuality, the literalists will go right to the Bible and start pointing out passages, you know, about the Lord did not condone this.
Mm-hmm.
But my point to him was, I would imagine as youngsters that even today that there is experimentation in homosexuality to the extent, no, I shouldn't say homosexuality, There's experimentation with sex.
Sure.
And they're in and they're out of it for the most part. Mm-hmm. No, except for the homosexual or the lesbian, who for probably physiological reasons cannot divorce himself. Now that's a whole new bag too, because people would say, no, wait a minute, that's a choice.
Right.
They can anybody can do it.
Right.
Which I don't accept.
Right.
But they can say anybody can do it.
Right.
But you know, you start getting into those kinds of
how does this connect with this question? I'm sorry, you kind of left me. How does
I think it was just with the church and scientific inquiry. Tangentially related, of course, because there is research in that area, I think, and that's what you're pointing to.
Sure.
Your point is well taken, and I think, as I said, that it's interesting for me to hear this. One thing I'd be very interested in knowing, though, is how you dealt with, in your biology classes, the theory of evolution. I mean, was it taken as a fact, or was it taken as we so often hear now that the school boards all over the country are mandating that there's a disclaimer about the theory of evolution, that this is a quote controversial theory? I mean, how did you handle it?
You know, I was just usually very open about it, and I would just declare today, whatever. Today we're going to be talking about the theory of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want to emphasize that. This is a theory.
Right.
This is not fact. This is not a law.
Mm-hmm.
This is a theory.
Right.
Now, I've had many occasions, really, where after we had discussed that particular unit, I would have students come up to me and say, Mr. Warner, would you mind if a friend of mine and I, if we came in with our Bibles and talked about Genesis?
Interesting.
And I would say, you're welcome to. And it never created, you know, it never became a problem. I never, in the 31 years of teaching, you know, I never had a parent call me up and say, what are you doing in that classroom?
Interesting.
Never a problem.
Wow. Because I'll tell you one thing, in Virginia, that would start a firestorm.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very definitely. And one, I think one, has to think, has to realize the way Virginia is. I mean, pretty far away from Virginia here, but Virginia is just across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C., and there's a sort of the bump of Virginia is what we call Northern Virginia. And after you get down past Richmond, things change dramatically. I mean, in all sorts of ways. In the way that people look at the Civil War. And I'll tell you, I've learned more about, you know, the Civil War just from being there than I learned in the entire course of history in high school, just because of the controversies and the debates that go on in places like that. Things change dramatically in the way that one looks at the relationship between church and state, believe it or not, the place of religion in public schools, prayer in public schools. All these things are very, very hotly debated in very different ways from one part of the state to the other. And Northern Virginia tends to be a more cosmopolitan area. It's sort of the home of the internet, really. Huge amounts of wealth being generated in that area, even now. And so it tends to be a little bit more highly educated area. It tends to be more open to scientific interpretations of, you know, the history of the human race and the history of the earth, things like that. And so these debates about prayer in public school do not go very far in Northern Virginia, where they do go, they get hotly debated in the southern and western parts of the state. But anyway, that's another story. I guess the other question that I have, and you've brought out some very interesting points about that. What do you think is responsible for this, the state of affairs that exists, or the non-state of affairs that exists, I guess, between the church and science? Why is it that we are not? Why is it that ne'er the twain shall meet, or that they're it's irrelevant?
Well, I have a thought on it. I've read these last Newsweek and Time magazine articles, the most recent ones. There's been a couple, three now.
Yeah, right.
There's one on this finding of this upright, person that walked upright and all this.
And the other one about how the earth will end.
Interesting. I can't argue evolution. I mean, I think it's something that has happened. We see it all the time. We see it in mutations of bacteria that are becoming immune to our penicillin. I mean, that's a kind of evolution.
Yeah.
And so I don't question about it. I think the dinosaurs certainly roamed the earth, and I'm glad I wasn't here then. But the thing that I just find as I read these articles, it seems to me that the writers of these articles are always not saying it, but implying that we do not need God in this equation. That somehow this is all the product of endless accidents. And I find that preposterous. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just find it not even intelligent. That's where I am on that. I think there has to be who's
Plato.
Prime mover.
Sure.
I don't see how there's any way of escaping that.
Well, I think you're in good company. Isaac Newton thought the same thing, and explicitly said that in a couple of his famous works on optics and on the Principia. Einstein felt the same way too, and he's widely quoted as saying God does not play dice. You know, he does not roll dice or play dice or something like that. And so,
that was Einstein's problem with accepting quantum mechanics.
Right, exactly. The probabilistic interpretation. Right, exactly. But I think he spoke for, you know, in sort of the general cosmological sense, he specifically addressed quantum mechanics, and yes, that's true.
May I raise another point, Steve?
Sure.
May or may not be germane to the original question back to you.
That's all right.
That is the creation story, and there was a number of them. You know, but the way people, as I understand it, I may be wrong, but the way back then they communicated was by a narration, a story. And that these were, I call them this, but people don't want to call it that because it's a long, big, long idea. But a story. To me, the scriptures was not a scientific textbook. It was a story of the fall of man and his salvation, period. That has nothing to do with how creation, how.
The actual mechanism.
Yeah. And so being it was a story, and if you start to think somebody had to write that and put it down, they didn't have the facts that we have today, so they get the order of things turned around. So what? That's the way I feel about it.
Right, and I hope that a number of people feel the same way. You had a comment.
Yeah, but you were addressing your question of, you know, the why. And since the beginning of the 20th century, about, you know, polarized, about 50% of the population believed in God. On a general, you know, mm-hmm. polling, whereas by the end of the 20th century, 95% of the U.S. population, anyway, believed in God. So you had a significant increase, and even among scientists, where it went from a very small percentage, like 6 or 7, to about 46% among scientists who believed in God in that same period. So this would... I think when you get a larger, you know, population believing, then having to decide what they believe in, you know, in connection with the evidence, the result of these controversies, I think. And evolution would be just a tip of the iceberg relative to throwing anthropology and archaeology, how threats to a literal interpretation are enormous suddenly.
Yeah. So you're actually taking sort of the opposite pathway and saying, well, now it's not really that the two are separated. They seem to be more in conflict than before, even.
It would seem.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And it threatens authority structures too. To those that, you know, you can't accept. If you can't work in within the idea of a metaphor, you know, if this particular book gives you your power or your authority,
right,
then you're in deep trouble if you don't get a consensus rather than
right. Yeah.
But it's also part of it's that dynamic of the authority structure, but it's also, I think, the other way around, and for churches, you hear a question of why I think the sociology of why the church seems silent about this is that it's anything that's controversial, churches tend to stay away from. And we've got 50 years or more of silence on this subject. In the church, and as this gentleman was saying, you know, there's like bacteria and stuff. I mean, there's, or even that increasing numbers of scientists through their studies are thinking deistically. There's something the church could enter into a dialogue that would be really helpful, but back in the Scopes monkey trial days or something. Fundamentalists took one position, and the mainstream church has started to be quiet. And so now we have this big gulf between church, I think of more than faith, but between church and science, where we have an agreement that we don't talk about the science. And that's not helping anybody. But if you start talking about science, then you're going to have fights in the congregation, so you don't do it.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because even now, and this is something we'll talk about on Friday when we try to come to a consensus or to develop a statement about how we feel about this, that it seems like the fundamentalist arm of the faith is doing all of the talking. They're the ones that are... have failed at the national level to require that, for example, creation science or intelligent design is the word that's used today. Which, brief parenthetically, note that brings us into conflict with the Platonic sort of idea that there was intelligent design, but yet I think the intelligent design community out there is using it for quite different purposes. But anyway, that's something that we'll talk about in time. But so I think it's extremely important that these groups have failed at the national level and have started to infiltrate local school boards with their ideas, and I have a very nice study on this that we'll talk about on Friday about, and the gist of it is that, well, look, you know, here is the tactic of the creation science movement, and here's what the true scientific movement can do to address that and go on the offensive as opposed to be completely defensive in these local school board meetings.
It's define the creation science movement. I don't know exactly
what it is I know about it more from the point of view of the earth sciences as opposed to the biological science aspect of it. But I think the gist of it, well, I know that the gist of it in terms of earth science is that the Bible is a scientific text that should be taken literally. I mean, and one that should be taken literally for what it says, that creation was carried out in 1 week, 6 days.
That's the creation science group.
No. Well, now, but it goes further than that now, because what they're doing is trying to take the scientific record and show that the biblical story of creation fits the scientific record. And one runs into monstrous absurdities in the application of that, and that's something that we'll talk about on Friday. But just for example, I'll just mention two very briefly. One is that one of the ways that we date in geological sciences, the way we date rocks and strata is through radioactive isotope dating, which is the decay of radioactive materials that occur naturally. Many metals have radioactive isotopes that are a very, very small part of the whole. For example, carbon-14. I mean, carbon-14 is coming out of these beams and out of your shirts and out of everything in your body by the minute. And one can measure that. And as something decays, then one can tell the age by the concentration of those isotopes. Well, anyway, that's in geological science, it's the ratios of these isotopes. So one like osmium just compared to krypton or something like that, where you can tell how old something is, and it's very, very precise. Very precise, indeed. And what the creation science movement has said is that there is evidence to suggest that the speed of light has changed over the course of time, so that apparently very, very large periods of time are actually very small. You know, a very small period of time will, say, 3,000 or 4,000 years will appear like millions of years because of this disparity in the speed of light from the time that this event took place until the time it's measured. And so that's one. The other, which is probably more preposterous, is the fact that their basic tenet is that all of the Earth's landforms, mountains out here, the Grand Canyon, all of these things basically took their shape within the year following the 40 days of rain. As the floodwaters receded, then all of these forms took place. The rock strata out here, the cliffs of Dover, for example, the chalk cliffs that, according to our calculations, evolved over millions of years from animals and their chalk-containing, calcite-containing skeletons were, laid down over eons. They propose, or their calculations show, I use calculations quite loosely, but their results, and I use that loosely too, I guess I don't know how to talk about it, but their literature says that those strata were laid down at the rate of 1 meter per day.
Wow.
Okay, so you're talking about this much every day. I mean, you could actually watch this happen, right? I mean, and that's not the quickest there's fault spreading, formation of lakes that happened over the course of days. You know, like it sort of opened up and boundaries of these spread visibly, like kilometers per hour. You know, just sort of all of a sudden happened. And what they're doing is using the paleontological record to support this. But if one goes ahead and actually approaches it from a scientific viewpoint, it completely destroys all of these arguments. I mean, they become preposterous. But what's happened is that what they're doing is putting themselves out in these public school meetings where they have what's called their science and a relatively, I don't want to say gullible, but
uninformed
population is willing to accept that. Why? Because it sounds scientific.
Yeah.
And that you're not having the other side to debate them and challenge what they're talking about. I mean, those are the two most monstrous distortions of the scientific record. Yeah, I guess I'm sorry you won't be here on Friday, but I can point you to the article that you can go and check out from your local library and read it. It's just amazing. And it's written for the lay person. It's not written for this
a creation science article.
No, it's here. I have it right here. It's called. It's written in the American Scientist in 1998. It's called Creationism's Geologic Timescale. And so, what the author does, the author is a retired professor from the University of Massachusetts. Who also served as chief scientist and deputy director of NASA's Office of Lunar Exploration. So a guy with very, very fine credentials has written this article urging the scientific community to stand up now and make your voice heard. Anyway, they have wonderful pictures in here, actually, and I'll just leave it if people want to take a look at it. But here's one of the explanations of the Great Flood, and I'll pass this around, is that the Earth was covered with this sphere that eventually just cracked open. But now you laugh, but they have apparently data that will support this. Now, if you look at this data in a scientific manner, you will see that it is not. That their position is untenable. But anyway, the caption is kind of funny. It says that at the center of the Earth in one creationist view, as yet undetected by seismology, is hell. And there's a little picture of the devil in there. But here, now here is one of the creation scientists, and I quote him now. Whenever Hades or Sheol is referred to in the Bible, it's always down in the earth. Now, this is a scientist talking. Okay, this guy has a PhD from a well-respected university, but has gone this creationist route. And that's what most of these people do. They get their PhDs from very reputable institutions and then go along this route. Of course, none of these publications are ever published in the open literature. They are published by their own publishing company, the Institute for Creation Research. Anyway, let me continue. It's always down in the earth, the depths of the earth. So right there in the center of the earth, apparently, there's a great opening that we can't really deal with in terms of our seismic instruments or other instrumentation. But apparently, it is there. You can take the Bible to mean what it says. I mean, it's not all together. Anyway.
Steve, now, is that a particular church? I mean, is it?
No.
Or is it just a, so, like, what kinds of churches do these people belong to?
I couldn't say, really.
Because when you talk about the church, they're Lutherans, okay. Because when you talk about, I mean, you'd hate to think of,
you know, this is the church, and so that's the church that we belong to, because, I mean, the word church is pretty broad here.
Right, I'm talking about that.
You know, and so you can talk about...
Well, you're right.
Yeah, and when you talk about the why do we believe this way, I think that, you know, a lot of it is because it's a safe haven for a lot of people. If you talk about some of the fundamentalists,
right.
It's certainly much easier route to go down than you would maybe a more open or questioning. I have my brother is a Lutheran pastor, and on our trip down here, we asked him the question, we got in the conversation about population, you know, growth. And I think if it was, I had a fundamentalist brother, you would say, well, that's easy. And it is easy. I mean, it's easy just to point to this article and say, you know, it's man's job to populate the earth and subdue it, blah, blah, blah. But his answer was, you know, that's not an area that I have really studied yet. I have to read and study and, you know, a very guarded answer. And you know, you got to look at the Hebrew definition of subdue, which means being stewards of.
Mm-hmm.
Good point. And so that means that if you don't ever give you an off-the-hand answer, it means that we need to be stewards of the earth, but to really give you a good answer, I would need to study it in depth for a period of time. So, you know, I mean, there's the church and then there's the church. I think
exactly.
The church could be, it's a lot easier. I mean, I lived with amongst the Mormons for a while, and I said, you know, I'm having trouble. Why these very educated people, some of them believe this? He goes, well, you got all the answers. How nice life would be if you had all the answers.
What, from the Book of Mormon or something? Or?
Yeah. You know, it's easy, you know. I got a question, here's the answer. Oh, okay. And it's over with. And boy, would that be nice.
They stopped coming to my house.
Well, part of it was, well, when I wasn't there and they stopped by, I think my wife made them feel rather unwelcome. But I always kind of enjoyed it when they showed up and you know, would talk to them about it and ask them why, just why. One of them actually gave me a copy of that book, and I started reading it. I mean, it's a good yarn, but it's... I don't know. Anyway, somebody had a comment. Yeah.
Well, I was going to mention, when you asked the publications, is anyone familiar with the... it's a quarterly publication from the School of Theology at the University of Chicago. And it's called Science and Spirit.
No.
And what it is truly... I think it's been out about 5 years now. And it seems like it's a genuine attempt to erase the adversarial climate that we have between so-called the church and the scientist.
Right.
Or science in general. Yeah, and it's... and there are numerous articles in there written by scientists, and there are numerous articles written in there by theologians.
Right.
And it's just giving points of view. And some you accept, some you don't.
Right.
But it is... it is quite a magazine.
That's
Science
interesting.
And Spirit.
That's interesting. I was a graduate student there, and I guess I would have expected them to promote the adversarial relationship as opposed to heal it. But that's great. An important step. And I think that's what I'm trying to think about here, in that in my own experience, I've always thought of scientific knowledge and advancement. I mean, obviously not all of it's good, but that it, just that knowledge of the natural world can illuminate, you know, the creation.
Steve, another area which we haven't touched on, I wonder whether you're going to do it, we came close to it a little ago, was genetic engineering in the church stand and for good and bad.
Uh-huh.
An interesting conflict there.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, I mean, we can do that at any time. What I'm doing here is just sort of making some guidelines about that. And if we want to delve into it, that's certainly great. Personally, I don't have a whole lot of background in that area. And maybe others do.
No, I don't. I know there's a controversy going on.
Right. And I think that controversy is different than the one we're talking about, as I think you brought up, is it turns out to be an ethical issue as opposed to a scientific issue about, you know, how do we view this science? I think in terms of that debate, one has to be, and again, you brought this up, as, you know, where does the church stand, or where does, not the church, anyway, I guess it's where does our faith stand on those kinds of issues about, you know, eventual discrimination or job opportunities or things like that, when are we going to have to submit to some sort of genetic testing in order to, kind of like a drug test, you know, when you go to get a job these days, it's mandatory. I mean, is it going to be a mandatory genetic test, you know, for whatever reasons?
Manipulating the genes to do this or that.
And then again, that's a whole other arm of that issue, which is very serious. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm from Canada, and the NGOs that relate to the ecumenical churches had just gone through a restructuring, and what I thought was really interesting is they added a new group that's never been there before, a working group on biomedical ethics.
Uh-huh.
And I think that part of a response to some of the silence of the church is starting to say, well, we are going to be talking about it, but we're going to be talking about it ecumenically rather than just at church.
Well, I think that's a great, great step, too, because I think that the church always has a lot of expertise and a lot of people who tend to think broadly about issues, and hopefully think broadly about issues, but have that ethical sort of feeling and can participate in that debate.
I'm getting back to this: why the silence? I think the church has, for probably at least our, I'll take people other than churches, have been looked upon largely as a refuge.
Mm-hmm.
I think people want the church to be a place where they're comfortable and mm-hmm. not getting upset, and so there's just been a kind of a conspiracy of silence to not raise up issues that are going to cause division. I think it's kind of sad.
Mm-hmm.
It's contradiction of really what the church is should be about. I recall the first Earth Day, which was a long time ago, I brought my brother in to speak, and my pulpit is a scientist from the University of Minnesota Duluth, and he talked about population. I lost members.
Really?
They would not belong to a church that allowed that kind of an idea to come from its pulpit. People
that kind of an idea.
Afraid of these things. They're just scared.
Really?
I think that speaks, as he said, to, you know, basic human trait. We don't like to get out of our comfort zone, and I think that can be individual or that can be as a community of faith. And I think, you know, we're a lot more comfortable talking about theologic issues, but as you indicate, you know, I think stem cell research is going to be a big issue, and mm-hmm. the church is going to have to get involved in that, you know. But I think it speaks to kind of a basic thing. We don't like to get out of our comfort zone. And the church, as he said, has been the kind of place where we're comfortable with the theology, but when we get into the science, we get, you know, they start getting uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, we're coming far afield from what I had written down in my notes, but I think that's great. I think the scientific community, in some respects, is looking toward the religious community to provide that kind of input to these questions. Because although I don't work in any areas that are overly controversial, I can see that. I can see how that, you know, where the community of scientists, we have a very active group in our laboratory who's working on origins of life. I mean, and it seems almost daily. Actually, I guess I should relate just one very interesting point, is the first paper I ever published was you know, unwittingly part of this origins of life debate. You know, it's very interesting. We were looking at how there was a hypothesis afloat at that time about the cycling of conditions, sort of going from hot, dry conditions to cold, wet conditions. And what we did was we just thought, well, why don't we try to see if proteins would... There was a difference in the way proteins sort of self-assembled in these different environments. And it turned out that when you cycled them, these conditions, the rates of change of these proteins, their growth, or what we call oligomerization, the piecing together of these units to create more complex molecules, increased dramatically. I mean, it was, in my mind, it was just a good piece of science because it was what we call mechanistic chemistry. How does this atom go and join to this atom and make bonds and then make bigger molecules? But it was actually sort of, as I said, unwittingly became part of the debate. I mean, we knew that it would, but we didn't know that it was going to be as spectacular a result as it turned out to be in the end. But anyway, I guess I appreciate your comments because it's really helped me to put this debate more in focus, and this series of lectures or discussions is something that I'm going to try to develop in more detail with you know, more slides and things like that, more concrete types of examples. But the thing that's been really critical, I think, for me, is to hear your input and to understand how people think about these things. Because I said, it's relatively new to me, this particular aspect of it. But it's almost lunchtime, and I don't want to keep you. Tomorrow, I think what I'll try to do is continue on with this, with some of the things that I was going to talk about, and give you sort of a one example of how I see scientific knowledge being an illuminator of sort of a divine presence in our scientific world, and that has to do with the periodic table. And so it'll be kind of an interesting discussion, and I'm anxious to hear what you have to say about that. So again, thanks for coming and sharing your input. It's been very valuable. So thanks. Write down that reference so you can go in. Yeah, I should.